You have been listening to 93.3 WNRB Wausau. Real life, real learning, real radio. Central Wisconsin's premier community radio station. Coming up next, the Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show, but first this public service announcement. On Saturday, May 13th at the Wausau Aspirus Hospital, there will be a no-cost screening clinic held to identify children in our area who might benefit from the experts in orthopedic or burn child care issues. Some of these issues that the Shriners help cover free of charge are orthopedic problems associated with cerebral palsy, leg length discrepancies, scoliosis, hand-back problems, and of course any child burn care issues they are world famously known for providing. Again, this is a free clinic and open to all children in our area. This totally free clinic will be held on Saturday, May 13th here in Wausau. And for more information regarding this event or any Shriners questions you might have, please feel free to contact Tom Passo at 842-7701. Again, that number to contact Tom Passo about the Shriners and the free clinic that's going to be offered on May 13th is 842-7701. I will be repeating this number again later. And also coming up on the Mike Cannon Show, there will be a 15-minute interview with Tom Passo, organizer of this up-and-coming free screening clinic, and we'll be talking about what the Shriners organization does and all the types of services offered to children through their efforts. Again, this interview will be coming up later in the Mike Cannon Show. And now, coming up next is the Mike Cannon Show, Indie Media Radio for Central Wisconsin. It's a show I guarantee the NSA is listening into, and please stop tapping my phone. Here comes this week's Mike Cannon Show.
Warning. The views expressed on the Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this Indie Media Radio Show, do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's host.
This is my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
Welcome to the continuing saga known as the Mike Cannon Show, Indie Media Radio for Central Wisconsin. Each Monday, I try to bring you shows and alternative voices from around the country and the world. Information you'll hear nowhere else except in the Central Wisconsin Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio program. A reminder that you may be listening to this community radio station, WNRB, on the radio at 93.3 FM, or perhaps you are checking us out on the web at one of our stream web links, like the one you can find at wnrb.blogspot.com. Any way you are listening to us, it is greatly appreciated. We, the volunteers at WNRB, put a lot of time and energy into this show and hopes that it is entertaining and or enlightening to our listeners. And we thank you for your ears, your hearts, and your attention. As always, if you have any questions, gripes, or comments about the specific Indie Media Radio show, you can contact me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's all one word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. So each week I try to bring you shows from other not-for-profit and or community radio stations from around the world that offers information of relevance to our Central Wisconsin listeners. I always try to bring you interviews with local people regarding Central Wisconsin stuff as well they might want to know about. And that is very true with this week's interview. So I start off this week's show with an interview with Tom Passo, who is organizing a free screening clinic for the area children on May 13th. Tom will talk a little bit about the Shriners do and the free services they offer to any children in our area. At the end of this 13-minute interview, I'll give you information on how to contact him if you have any questions regarding the free medical screening clinic coming up on May 13th. Again, here is an interview with Tom Passo.
My name is Tom Passo, a member of the Wisconsin Valley Shrine Club and a member of the Board of Governors of the Shrine Hospital for Children, Twin Cities Unit at Minneapolis.
I must admit, Tom, that I don't know a lot about the Shriners organization and exactly what they do. I was wondering if you could just briefly talk a little bit about its history and its mission.
Certainly, Mike. Well, first of all, Shriners are well known for their parades, their circuses, and those types of things within the community. But a basic background. Every member of the Shrine is a member, first of all, of the organization known as Freemasons, which is a Masonic order that's the oldest and largest fraternal organization in existence in the world. In order to be a Shriner, you first must be a member of the Masonic group. However, not every member of the Masons chooses to be a Shriner. And the history of the Shrine is basically this. In the late 1870s, 1880s, a group of men who were active in their Masonic lodges felt there was a need for them on a more social basis to continue the camaraderie that they were building within their fraternal organization. So they established the what they called the Shrine. It was established in New York City in 1872. And over time, in the major metropolitan areas, a Shrine group grew up. And up until 1918, 1920, World War II, and every Shrine group at the time had their own philanthropy. And philanthropy was a basis of their reason to get together socially. They wanted to get together socially, but for a purpose. So every one of them decided that they would do this in the name of a charity. Well, they also got together on an annual basis for a convention. And as they compared notes and so on and so forth in the late World War II, in early 1920s, polio was a major epidemic among young people. And they were recognizing this. So over a course of about two or three conventions, it got talked about that maybe we should band together and attack this debilitating disease that was afflicting so many young people in the United States. So at the 1922 annual meeting of all these Shrine groups from throughout North America, they decided that they would band together, create one charity, and they decided they would establish a system of hospitals across the United States that would be dedicated to pediatric orthopedics, the disabling effects of a variety of different things, but in particular polio for young people from birth through age 18. So out of that was born the Shrine Hospital System. The first hospital opened was in Shreveport, Louisiana in 1922. The second hospital was in Minneapolis in 1923, and the only reason Shreveport beat us to opening was the construction time. So the second oldest hospital system sits right in your backyard. This has grown to a nationwide organization of hospitals, 22 strong, that stretch across the entire continent of America into Hawaii. We have also one in Mexico City, we also have three burn centers, one in Galveston, Texas, one in Cincinnati, one in Boston, and another one in Sacramento, California. But the dedication of Shrine Hospitals that started with the treatment of polio has evolved to treatment of all types of diseases that are pediatric orthopedic related. And we can go into some of those common conditions later, Mike.
Great, thanks. So the mission of the Shriners and the Shriners Hospitals and the burn centers is mostly to help out younger people with their health issues. How does that go about? How does that specifically relate to, let's say, a person from Wausau or the Central Wisconsin area who might need some help?
Very good question, Mike. As I mentioned, we concentrate in a certain area, so there are certain diseases that we do work with. For instance, the orthopedic complications of cerebral palsy. We cannot do anything about the disease itself, but we can certainly do lots of things to ease those debilitating effects. We work with brittle bone disease. We work with either leg amputations, arm amputations that are a result of either birth defects or accidents. And with summer coming up, Mike, I need to do this. I need to ask your audience to be very, very, very conscious of power lawnmowers in kids. Because the worst thing I hate to see when I go to the hospital in Minneapolis is a new patient of ours who's lost parts of limbs or legs as a result of accidents with lawnmowers. Kids should not be anywhere near these. And I annually cringe when I see at some point in time a grandparent or a parent with a child in arms or a youngster riding a lawnmower tractor. please, please don't do that. But after getting off my soapbox, Mike, how we fit in the area is we are not there to replace local medical facilities. We are there to support them. We are there to provide treatment for people who either, number one, cannot afford it, or it's a financial impact upon their family, or in a lot of cases, especially in rural areas that your audience might be coming from, they do not have access to the type of medical care that we provide for those areas. And since we have a focus and have been at it for 80 years plus, we have become a center of excellence in pediatric orthopedics and have trained nearly 70% of all orthopedic surgeons in the United States come through our facilities one or the other as part of their training, because that's another mission of ours, is education in the medical community, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But if someone does have a child or knows a neighbor or a friend or whatever else who may have a child that may be of the type of condition that we can support, I would certainly encourage them to make contact, get the information in, because the main important factor we need to talk about, Mike, is that all care provided at a Shrine hospital is, again, 100% free. There are no charges to any family. We do not charge insurance companies. There are no federal, state, or local tax dollars involved. All care, and we're provided at Shrine hospitals nationwide, is 100% funded by the Shrine. And to talk about that just briefly, right now our budget for 2005, Mike, is $625 million, which basically equates down to nearly $20,000 an hour while we're in operation. And we've been doing it for over 80 years, and we have the ability to help people with those conditions and encourage someone, as we talk maybe a little later, about some of the types of things we do and some of the patients in the area, and give you examples.
So, Tom, I was curious. I'm quite amazed by the concept that you might be taking children who have some medical needs to these hospitals, and even though they might be somewhat covered by insurance companies and their policies, the Shriners opt not to try to bill the insurance companies. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about why the Shriners had that philosophy.
Sure. It evolves from our initial concept back in the 1920s, as I mentioned earlier, that we were organized, and one of the purposes, other than the social aspect, was the charitable aspect. And so we maintain that diligently. Secondarily, there isn't a single Shrine hospital that has a billing office. Now, if you have a billing office, that's a cost. We feel we can use those dollars that would be necessary to try to collect payment and do this and so on and so forth for actual patient care, so it's a wash-off that way. Secondarily, we've been blessed by a lot of people both within the Shrine fraternity itself and non-members of the Shrine who believe in our mission of helping kids, who realize that we run a very lean and mean organization. Roughly 95 cents of every dollar that we receive in contributions to the Shrine hospitals is used for actual patient care. We don't spend a ton of money on fundraising and administrative and support staff and so on and so forth. It's a lot of volunteer effort in order to carry that part out. We have paid professional staff. We are accredited by the same organizations that credit every community hospital in existence in the United States. And quite frankly, in the 19 years that I've been on a Shrine Hospital Board at Minneapolis, and we get accredited every 3 years, we've got nothing less than an excellent accreditation and everything. So we are not a charitable hospital that a lot of people think of. That there, I would invite anybody who's in the Twin Cities area to look us up on East River Parkway and take a tour for themselves. They'd be very, very impressed with the quality of facilities that are there. And so on. But it's our philosophy that it's a philanthropy, and as long as we're able to raise the funds through a variety of different means, every Shriner pays an annual fee, every Shriner is charged with responsibility of assisting that effort. People have been just gracious to us in many ways. Corporations have done donations and so on because they believe in that same work that we believe in.
Great. That was, I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about, again, some of the situations that might have occurred in the Central Wisconsin community and how the Shriners have helped out those situations.
Sure. To give you an idea, I mentioned at the beginning of the program, Mike, that I'm a member of Wisconsin Valley Shrine Club. There are other Shrine Clubs around the area. But the Wisconsin Valley Shrine Club is made up of a group of members of Shriners from this area who get together. And our emphasis is in seeking and answering questions of families who have a child that we may be able to assist with our program at the Shrine Hospital, either at the Twin Cities unit at Minneapolis or the unit at Chicago. And we'll talk about the differences between those two a little bit later, Mike. But We provide assistance to those families if necessary for them to get transportation back and forth to their appointments at either Chicago or Minneapolis. If necessary, there are Shriners who will take their personal time and drive them over and bring them back. If the child is hospitalized over there, for instance, at Minneapolis, we've got a women's auxiliary that's built a wonderful facility alongside of our new hospital, which I mentioned we were originally built in 1923. Well, in the late 1980s, when I first came on the board, we were in a process. We tore that hospital down and built a brand new one that we dedicated in 1989, a state-of-the-art facility that will last us for the next 100, 150 years. So we have an on-site housing facility, so we'll even put the parents up necessary over there. So we do those types of things. The best thing I can answer for you is right now off the top of my head, in the greater Wausau area, and I'm going to say that's going to be a range of maybe 25, 30 miles, Antigo to north of Stevens Point, west over to Marshfield, and north to Minocqua. We probably at the present time have about 125 patients who are active at the Twin Cities unit alone in a variety of different ways and different things that are doing treatments on an annual basis or a follow-up basis or whatever is necessary to doing that. So we as Shriners have that obligation in order to get them over there and make them aware of it, where it's at, and so on. I'll give you a couple quick examples of children throughout the area types of situations that we've helped. I became aware of a young man in the Edgar area approximately 7-8 years ago who was born with one leg about 6 inches shorter than the other, about 5.5 inches shorter than the other one. And one of the areas of excellence that the Shrine Hospital has, and particularly at Minneapolis, is an area called limb lengthening. There was a procedure that was originally developed in Russia in the early 60s, and when the Shrine became aware of it, they sent a study team over there to analyze that technique and bring it back to the United States, adapt it to American medical practices, and it's called the Ilizarov method. And basically what it amounts to, Mike, is with a limb that's shorter, works particularly well on legs but also does it on arms, we'll go in and actually break that bone and attach rods through the bones up and below, and then there's an external skeleton of stainless steel that keeps those bones just close to mending. And of course that's the advantage of youth, they're always, their bones are growing. So over a course of time, and the family has taught this, they keep that bone just away from each other and it actually grows new bone. To make a long story short, this young man went in the summer after he was a fifth grader. His right leg was about nearly 5.5 inches shorter than his left. He had the surgery. By the time he came back in the sixth grade to have another follow-up and so on and so forth, we already grown 3 inches on that leg. Over the course of the next year and so on and so forth, when he finished him off with his treatment procedure and the so on and so forth, his right leg had grown to within a quarter inch of his left. The young man has since graduated from high school, but during junior high and senior high, he played basketball. That's a good example. Another young man that I'm aware of out of the Mosin area a number of years back, people might remember when there was this flammable pajama material out on the market. And a young man, unfortunately, a young boy, about 3 years old, happened to crawl near a stove. And as a result of that incident, he had to have both legs amputated. We've provided him with a prosthesis as he's grown, and these kids grow very fast. He's moved to the Antigo area, the last I heard, and he was playing soccer. So those are the kinds of things. Now, there's other things. There's a young lady here in Wausau that I became aware of that had cerebral palsy. As I mentioned, we cannot do anything for cerebral palsy itself. But she was at the point where she was being carried throughout the home by family members because she just did not have the ability to walk. And after a number of surgeries, a number of different procedures and so on and so forth, she just graduated from Wausau East last year, and she walked across the stage with hand crutches only. So those are the kind of things that are there.
Tom, if anybody has questions about possibly their children might be of need and maybe if they qualify, or just would like to know a little bit more about the Shriners, do you have a contact information that they could contact?
Certainly. I'd be happy to answer questions personally. They can contact me. My name is Tom Passel. My office number is 842-7701. So that's 842-7701. I'd be glad to get the information to you. Or if you know a Shriner in your neighborhood, your church, contact them. They'd be willing to help you as well.
Tom, thanks again for your time. If there's a youth out there that has some issues in central Wisconsin, I'm wondering again if you could just briefly go down some of the things that the Shriners do cover and some of their specialties.
Certainly, Mike. Just as a general and else, again, I mentioned it's pediatric orthopedic problems. We are not the answer for all things. But in that area, for instance, I mentioned cerebral palsy, the orthopedic problems with that. Foot deformities, club foot is a very common treatment that we work with. Hip problems, very common with youngsters that can occur. Juvenile arthritis is an amazing medical problem that's out there. I also talked a little bit before about limb deficiencies or deformities. Rickets. Rickets, even in our age, is still a major problem and can be done. Spine deformities. Spina bifida is another problem that, again, is fairly common, more so than we want it to be. Brittle bone disease, another one. So those types of things. I would also encourage people that have a child, for instance, cleft palate. That's an area specifically, Minneapolis doesn't deal with it, but our Chicago unit does deal with cleft palate problems. So again, when in doubt, ask the question. It doesn't cost you anything to ask the question. It doesn't cost anything to get an application in. It doesn't cost anything to find out. And we're there for information for you. So again, I would encourage anyone listening who may know of a child or would like further information, they can contact me. And again, that local number is 842-7701. There's also a national toll-free number they can call at any time and they'd be referred to the right area. And that is 1-800-237-5055. That's 1-800-237-5055. Or in today's internet access area, if they go to the website, it's Shriners. HQ.org. That's SHRINERSHQ.org. And they'll find a wealth of information on all of our hospitals and even an application they can fill out online and shoot it in. So again, I appreciate the opportunity to bring the word about the Shriners Hospitals. Mike, if during the course of the time, whether it's 6 months or 6 years from now, we help a child resolve this program, it'll be well worth it for both our time.
Thanks again, Tom, for your time.
That was an interview I got from Tom Pass about this time last year, talking about what the Shriners offer and reminding us that a free Shriners screening clinic will be held at Wausau Spires Hospitals Saturday, May 13th. And again, you can contact Mr. Passo at 842-7701. That's 842-7701. I highly recommend that if you know of a child in your family or perhaps you have a neighbor that might be a benefit of this amazing free service, please have them contact Mr. Passo for more information. And that number again was 842-7701.
You know you only had one shot to make it right, to do the right thing. So listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
And now, Xbox Magazine's Nerd of the Year, Mike Cannon.
Coming up next is a show I try to bring you each week out of Seattle, Washington, called Eat the State. You know, it's funny. I try to watch the Sunday morning yak shows on the Main Street media. You know, Meet the Press, This Week, Fox's News, We Regurgitate, You Lap It Up. And I watch these national, international, Main Street press, and I almost never hear what the alternative or European press is reporting. Well, here's a Sunday morning radio show with a little different news than you'll hear on these other television stations. And I can guarantee you, you won't hear this news on our all-hate AM radio station here in town either. Again, for an alternative voice, here is Seattle's Eat the State.
We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Tons to cover, so...
Yeah, I feel great.
This is national. We can always jump back to local at the end if you have some time. Okay, CIA apparently had sent a report dealing with the Niger uranium cakes.
Yes, and this happened 16 days before the 2003 State of the Union address with the infamous 16 words from President Bush talking about how Sodom, I think he always called him Sodom, just like his dad, was trying to seek uranium from Africa for the purpose of building nuclear weapons. Well, this... It had already been known that there were serious doubts within the State Department and the CIA as to the authenticity of this claim, but it turns out that the State Department had, by this point, already identified the documents that it had been based upon as forgeries. We already knew that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, had identified them in March, a couple months later, as crude forgeries. But we now know that the State Department had it figured out also, and that they knew, and the CIA knew, and presumably also because it was considered key to the case for invading Iraq, that the White House knew that these were forgeries, and Bush went ahead, and speechwriters went ahead and made the claim anyway in the 2003 State of the Union address. So this is just, you know, one more piece of evidence that it wasn't just that the president was cherry-picking intelligence that he liked, and Cheney was doing the same thing. They were orchestrating a campaign knowingly based upon lies, that Bush was lying, Cheney was lying, Rice was lying, Powell was lying, all of them, in order to stampede the country into war, and they succeeded.
All right. And General Jeffrey Miller apparently is going to have some explaining to do.
Yeah, Jeffrey Miller, for folks who haven't been following it closely, is the link between Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. He was the base commander at Guantanamo that was in charge of interrogation of prisoners there, and then he was sent by Donald Rumsfeld to Abu Ghraib to, quote-unquote, gitmoize the interrogation process in Abu Ghraib, which he then did a spectacular job of. He has never actually been forced to testify as to his role in any of the various scandals and prosecutions at Abu Ghraib, and that's he's been asked to testify, but he's invoked his right to refuse to self-incriminate, and that's important because without that, the White House and the Pentagon have been able to portray these cases as the quote-unquote a few bad apples, because there's been no testimony that has actually come out and said, well, these interrogations were part of a specific policy that came down from on high. It came down from General Miller. It came down from Donald Rumsfeld. Because Miller's never been asked under oath what his role in this was, how much of it he knew about, how much of it he ordered, and on whose authority he ordered it. Now there's a case, one of the last cases actually that's being prosecuted, of the dog handler at Abu Ghraib. And he's being prosecuted, and of course this is, you know, just another sort of ordinary grunt. But his defense attorneys have succeeded in doing what the prosecutors have been refusing to do. The government doesn't want any of these muckety-mucks testifying because, of course, they have to answer to the same muckety-mucks. But the defense attorneys finally succeeded where past defense attorneys have failed in convincing a judge that Miller should testify. If he does testify, he's going to be asked only about the dog handling case, you know, whose idea was it to use dogs on prisoners, etc. But there's a fair amount of evidence that Rumsfeld himself approved the use of dogs, certainly at Guantanamo Bay, probably at Abu Ghraib as well, and it may be the first opportunity in a trial to link Rumsfeld with all of this. So in addition to all of the retired generals speaking out and calling for his resignation, Rumsfeld may have some legal problems right now, because this may be the first opportunity in a court to actually link him to policies of torture involving the United States.
All right. Well, we were going to cover it last week, but we ran out of time. The White House apparently liked to reach out and touch someone.
Yes. This is kind of a fascinating case that has not gotten a lot of publicity. There have been several Republican operatives, three of them and then a fourth that's under prosecution right now, but three that have already pled guilty and are serving time, basically, for an election scandal in 2002 in New Hampshire. And what this was a scheme by the Republicans to jam the phones of the Senate Get Out the Vote campaign, so that, you know, all of the different volunteers who call people to remind them to vote and who offer rides to little old ladies to get them to polling places and all of the things that both Democrats and Republicans do to try and get their base supporters out to the polls to actually poll. This was a very close Senate race involving an incumbent Democrat and then John Sununu, the former Reagan chief of staff who was running for Senate for the Republicans. He was the former governor of New Hampshire at that point. Very close race. The Republicans succeeded in jamming the phones of the Democrats, and the Republicans won that race very narrowly. It's one of the pickups in 2002 that they had in the Senate. Well, it turns out that, of course, this is blatantly illegal, and the top guy for Republican election stuff in New England was a guy named James Tobin has been convicted in conjunction with this scheme. Well, it turns out that on election day, Mr. Tobin, while he's in the process of carrying out this phone jamming thing from New Hampshire, he's in New Hampshire doing this, there were dozens upon dozens of calls placed to the White House policy office, Karl Rove's office, between Tobin and somebody the White House won't say who was actually at that phone number at that time. But somebody in the White House was actually coordinating this campaign. You know, we don't know what Karl Rove knew about this. We don't know who behind in the White House was actually involved in this, but this is a criminal conspiracy that resulted in a Republican being elected to the U.S. Senate, and the White House is up to it in its neck, and to its neck, and it really hasn't gotten very much attention. It's kind of remarkable.
All right, moving along, the House Ethics Committee. It looks like they're going to be doing some musical chairs.
Yeah, well, the House Ethics Committee hasn't been hasn't actually met ever since Tom DeLay took the guy who was chairing it, who had this was in 2004 that the House Ethics Committee had reprimanded DeLay three separate times for different ethics violations, even with a Republican chairperson. Well, DeLay didn't like this, so he found a stooge, and the stooge was Doc Hastings of Eastern Washington, who has been the chair since early 2005, and the House Ethics Committee, despite the Abramoff scandal, despite Duke Cunningham, despite all the different corruption cases that have been going on in the House, has not even met. You go to Doc Hastings' website, and there's not even any mention that he actually chairs this committee. It's remarkable. It's like they disbanded the committee. But it does still exist. And the top-ranking Democrat on the committee is a Democrat from West Virginia. His name, his name is Alan Mulahan. And he is one of the only Democrats in the country. He's from West Virginia. He's only one of the only Democrats in the country in the House who's in serious re-election trouble. And he's in re-election trouble because of an ethics scandal that this week forced him to actually resign his post on the House Ethics Committee. He's getting a lot of pressure back home. And the reason he's getting a lot of pressure back home is it's a pretty good reason. Over the last decade, he's used his post on the Appropriations Committee to funnel approximately $250 million in government funds to five different nonprofit agencies that he set up. It seems pretty egregious. But what this means is that when the Democrats talk about taking back the House, we've heard, incessantly that, you know, it's going to be 15 seats that are necessary. In fact, when one of the top Democrats in the country in the House, came to fundraise for Darcy Burner last week, he was talking about, you know, this district is 1/15th of what the country needs to take back the House. Well, no, it's not. It's 1/16th because this Mulahan is in real danger and likelihood of losing his seat to a Republican this November. And what this unfolding ethics scandal means is it's going to be that much more difficult with all the gerrymandered House districts in the country and so few races actually in play. It's actually going to be that much more difficult for the Democrats to take back the House. So people need to be aware of this case.
All right, moving along. The architect, Karl Rove, appears to be moving on to other duties.
Yes, and this was widely, when it happened on Wednesday, the same day, incidentally, that Patrick Fitzgerald's grand jury heard testimony against Rove in conjunction with Valerie Plamegate. So Rove is not out of the legal woods by any stretch, but this was widely seen as a demotion. He, in addition to being the president's chief policy, political advisor, he had taken on the role for the past year or so of being the chief policy advisor. Well, then practice this hasn't meant very much because Bush hasn't had very many policies. He certainly hasn't had many policies that succeeded in getting much traction in Congress. But and he's probably wasn't going to for the rest of the year because what the Republicans are really focused on right now is a desperate struggle to keep control of both the Senate and the House in November because they know, and the White House especially knows, that if the Democrats take over either chamber of Congress, they'll have subpoena power, they'll be able to launch investigations, and Bush will not be able to do anything for the next 2 years except hire and spend a lot of money on lawyers. So by giving up this role, it's not a demotion. It means that Karl Rove is going to spend full time for the rest of the year doing nothing but coordinating the campaign that will attempt to keep the Republicans in power in the House and the Senate. He won't have any other duties to distract him from that, because the Republicans realize that that's the whole ballgame. That policy questions are really going to be secondary this year for them. They're not even going to try to do anything other than stay in power.
And who's replacing him?
A guy named Joel Kaplan is replacing him. And there's an interesting story about Joel Kaplan, too, it turns out, that has not gotten a lot of media attention this week. Mr. Kaplan, it turns out, was one of the, in fact, he coined this term, was one of the Brooks Brothers rioters. He was one of the people who staged this fake mob that pressured election counters in Florida during the recounts between Gore and Bush in 2000. You may remember that there was this very well-dressed heel of anger. Angry Republicans that converged, I think it was Palm Beach County, that really intimidated the election counters there and got a huge amount of publicity. And it was even clear at the time that this was a wholly astroturf operation. This was not spontaneously outraged Florida Republicans. This was a nationally coordinated thing. But it turns out some of the participants in that so-called riot are now well positioned and have nice jobs within the White House. And it turns out one of them now is the chief policy advisor to President Bush. How about that?
Huh. All right, quickly, the IMF is singling out a specific country this week for some work.
Yeah, the IMF does a global report on the global economy every year and identifies countries that it thinks poses a risk to the global economy. And of course, this is sort of a precursor to imposing structural adjustment programs and all the other prescriptions that are imposed in order to receive international credit. Well, guess who got singled out this week? The United States and the Bush administration for its record trade and federal deficits. Even more remarkable because the IMF is controlled not by one country, one vote, as in the UN, but countries get votes depending on the size of their economy. So the United States has dominated the IMF for years. It's one of the chief complaints of the Global South, that the U.S. uses the IMF and the World Bank, where it has essentially voting control, in order to impose economic policies on the rest of the world that are favorable to the United States. Well, now the United States is, in part of President Bush's ongoing and wildly successful campaign to turn us into a third world country, this is just another benchmark that the IMF is starting to look at the United States economy as a third world economy. And, you wonder how long it'll be before the IMF starts telling us to get rid of our remaining social programs. It's just remarkable that our economy has come to this in only 5+ years from having a record trade surplus when Bush took office.
All right, jumping to international, I'd like to start with Iraq, since there's multiple things on that.
Yeah, it was a really important week in Iraq. It looks like we have a new unity government finally. The United States has prevailed. Al-Jafari, the previous prime minister, after saying on Wednesday that stepping aside was out of the question, on Thursday he stepped aside. And it's been the United States in particular that was really pressuring Al-Jafari and the Shiites and the Iraqi government very, very hard to form the kind of quote-unquote national unity government that the U.S. wanted. And, of course, a lot of people in Iraq are very upset about this. I mean, they want a government. There's been no functional government in Iraq. In fact, a lot of the country, there's no government services, there's no security, there's no nothing. But the whole idea that you can have, and Palestinians have discovered this too, that you can have an election, that you can elect whoever you want, and if it displeases the United States, those people will not be able to take office, or the country will be punished if those people do take office. Well, the Shiites in Iraq have discovered this again. They could not go with Al-Jafari. But what they have done instead is a new prime minister, a guy named Jawal al-Maliki, who is a very close ally of Al-Jafari. He's very conservative, probably a lot of the same policies. You're likely to probably see a new minister in the Interior Ministry, because the United States is pressuring on that also. But the question of whether the Shiite-dominated government of Iraq, even though it's a so-called national unity government, right now the actual government is very much one side in the unfolding civil war, because it's the Shiites versus the Sunnis is where a lot of the bloodshed is coming from, and all the security agencies, the Interior Ministry, the police, the military, are very much dominated by the militias associated with Shiite religious parties, and that probably will not change anytime soon.
All right. And some NGOs had a report this week?
Yes. 125 NGOs came out with a reporting that since January, I mean, this is just remarkable, since January, 20,000 Iraqis have been kidnapped, including 5,000 women and 2,400 children. No word yet on how many of those people are dead, but you can probably bet with this 5,000 women and 2,400 children that a fair number of them are winding up, say, in Southeast Asia. This is not just sectarian violence, although a lot of it is sectarian violence. A lot of it also is criminal. There's simply no security in Iraq. There's no risk to carrying out criminal activity. So you're getting mob rule. You're getting mafia rule. In addition to the terrorism, in addition to the unfolding civil war, in addition to the insurgency against occupying United States troops, it's no wonder Iraq is such a mess.
All right. And reconstruction scandals?
Yeah. Philip Bloom, a business person, pleaded guilty this week to conspiracy, bribery, and money laundering charges. This is just a remarkable little story. He spent $2 million bribing United States officials, none of whom have been prosecuted yet, as far as I know. In return, he got $8.6 million in cost-plus contracts with an average 25%+ profit margin. So it was a very profitable investment in bribing U.S. officials for Mr. Bloom. The only problem was he got caught, but probably an awful lot of other business people did not get caught, or at least have not been prosecuted yet. Bloom is one of the first.
All right. Jumping over to Afghanistan, things continue to unravel there.
Yeah, they're very much unraveling. Over 20 civilians were killed in a three-day period, and later this week, a rocket was actually fired in Kabul, which is sort of one of the last peaceful places in Afghanistan. Rocket was fired on the U.S. embassy, actually missed and hit the courtyard of state television next door. But it tells you that not only is much of the country not under control, not even of the Afghanistan government that's, you know, was basically put in place by the United States, but not even the associated war wars that the U.S. has been paying off in order to, you know, grow their poppy and ship heroin to Western Europe and the United States for the last several years. The country is, more and more of the country is falling under the control of the Taliban and associated religious parties, and we're gonna have chaos in Afghanistan, just like we had this steadily growing insurgency for the last several years in Iraq. Afghanistan is becoming just as much of a problem.
All right, and developments in Iran this week.
Yeah, some really important ones. There's a report this morning, at least according to the Iranian envoy to the International Atomic Energy Agency, that Iran in principle anyway, has reached an agreement with Russia to go in for a joint venture for uranium enrichment that would be done on Russian soil. The question at this point is whether Iran would be doing that in addition to, or in place of doing it on Iranian soil, which is the key demand of Europe and the United States, is that they stop doing that. If it's instead of, this could actually defuse the crisis. It would probably be to the great disappointment of the White House. But since the United States is refusing to negotiate with Iran, and in fact, there was a fascinating report from Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Powell chief of staff this week, that the neocons surrounding Bush actually stopped the United States from negotiating on nuclear issues with Iran in 2002-2003. They wanted to keep it off the table so that they could use the nuclear issue against Iran later on, and of course, we're seeing exactly that. That's what's happening. Diplomacy may have succeeded in this case, despite the strongest efforts of the United States to make sure that it not succeed. That's the significance of this morning's report.
Talking once again with Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State's a volunteer publication that comes out every couple of weeks, free news. It's also available on the web at www.eatthestate.org, including all of our back issues.
And now, the man who doesn't misrepresent evidence to the UN, Mike Cannon.
That was a little alternative news program called Eat the State out of Seattle, Washington. See, I told you won't hear about this on your local all-hate AM radio station in town. Next, a fast little report called In the News. Today, they'll report about how Dick Cheney was able to use the tax breaks for the rich that he was given and only had to pay 5.4% of the millions of dollars of income he made last year. Yep, his 10-plus millions he made, he only had to pay 5.4% to the government. How's your taxes working for your last year? Did you only have to pay 5.4% to the federal government for the millions that you made? Here's that short 8-minute piece called In the News.
This is In the News for April 19th, 2006. I'm Scott Berguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. First story today is from The Independent in the United Kingdom. Out of India, one woman protest helps halt huge Indian dam project is written by Justin Hugler. From a hospital bed, a starving woman has brought the biggest infrastructure project in a booming India to its knees. The Supreme Court has ruled that work on a massive dam on the Narmada River cannot be completed unless thousands of people whose homes will be flooded are relocated and rehabilitated. It was a victory for protesters who included the Booker Prize-winning novelist Arundhati Roy and the Bollywood movie star Aamir Khan, but mostly it was a victory for a woman who went on hunger strike for 20 days to draw attention to the plight of those living in the shadow of the dam. Medha Patkar is the most famous human rights activist in India, but when she and fellow activists began a hunger strike in Delhi in March, it was dismissed as just a publicity stunt. But the weeks passed and the hunger strike went on. After almost 3 weeks, Ms. Patkar's health was deteriorating fast, but she had forced the dam on to the front pages of all India's national newspapers day after day and made herself a political force the Indian government could not ignore. She was taken to hospital against her will by police, but hospital staff did not force her to eat. Hunger strikes are deeply respected in India, where they were enshrined in the national consciousness by Mahatma Gandhi. The standoff pitched her against Narendra Modi, the chief minister of Gujarat state, who called off a visit to Britain last year after human rights activists said they would try to have him arrested for crimes against humanity during the Gujarat massacres of 2002. At stake was a multi-million-dollar scheme to build 30 dams on the Narmada River to relieve water shortages across four states and provide hydroelectric power. Parts Gujarat stands to gain from the project, and Mr. Modi is a staunch supporter. He even began his own hunger strike, but he gave up after 30 hours. One of the biggest challenges facing India is the drastic shortage of water in many areas. Hundreds of farmers have committed suicide after their crops failed during droughts, and in many areas, there are warnings the water table could run out completely. But Ms. Patkar and her Save the Narmada movement, which has campaigned against the dams for 20 years, say the homes of hundreds of thousands of people will be flooded in Madhya Pradesh state. She says they are being ignored because they are poor. Ms. Patkar began her hunger strike when work started on raising the biggest dam, the Sardar Sarovar, from 110 meters to 121 meters. Under pressure, the federal government sent a team to investigate the rehabilitation efforts. The team found that the activists' accusations were largely correct. At the largest site where families were being relocated, the minister said they were, quote, amazed that no sanitation, no drinking water, no system of sewage, no roads, much less the facilities like hospital, water reservoir, school, post office have been provided here, end quote. Displaced families were being encouraged to accept cash handouts instead of proper rehabilitation, and the government was charging them income tax on the handouts. The Save the Narmada movement says if the dam is raised, 35,000 families will lose their homes in monsoon rains in 3 months. The Supreme Court has ordered that work on the dam should continue for now, but warned that if rehabilitation was not carried out swiftly, it would order a complete stop to the work. Ms. Patkar ended her hunger strike on Monday. She staggered from her hospital bed to give a statement, but refused to see it as a victory, saying she was disappointed the Supreme Court had allowed work to continue. She vowed to fight on. That is taken from commondreams.org and appeared in The Independent in the United Kingdom, again written by Justin Hugler. Next up, from High Country News at hcn.org, Sarah Gilman reports, mass wolf kill rests on shaky science. Idaho's Fish and Game Department wants to boost the low-low management zone's dwindling elk herd by killing up to three-quarters of the area's estimated 58 wolves and maintaining low wolf numbers for the next 5 years. But some biologists and conservation groups question the science behind the plan, the department's first attempt to manage Idaho's wolves since the federal government granted it the authority in January. The elk herd, 27,000 strong in the early 1980s, has collapsed to 5,000 animals. But habitat loss, not wolves, is to blame, says Suzanne Asher Stone of Defenders of Wildlife. Decades of wildfire suppression have allowed dense forests to reclaim many of the open meadows the elk need for forage and calving grounds. State biologists agree that habitat is the key concern, but Jim Unsworth, the department's wildlife chief, says the Forest Service can't restore it fast enough. Quote, when you have great habitat, he says, predators aren't an issue, end quote. Department computer models indicate that wolves are keeping elk numbers down, but John Kai, a University of Idaho biologist who reviewed the proposal for the state, points out that a bigger herd could outgrow the existing habitat and crash. Retired University of Idaho wildlife professor Jim Peek said, quote, these guys aren't wolf haters. They have to manage the elk, end quote. The herd's number remain low despite the fact that the state already manages the area's bears and cougars through hunting. Reducing wolf predation through aerial gunning and trapping, says Unsworth, is, quote, the last tool in our toolbox, end quote. The department sent the proposal to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service April 4th for review. Again, that's from High Country News at hcn.org and written by Sarah Gilman. And finally today, a press release from Citizens for Tax Justice. Bush tax cuts save President $26,000. Cheney, $1.1 million in 2005. This is dated April 18th out of Washington, D.C. On Good Friday, April 14th, 2006, President Bush and Vice President Cheney released their federal income tax returns for 2005. An analysis by Citizens for Tax Justice of the White House figures shows, due to the 2001-05 Bush tax cuts, the President's 2005 income tax was reduced by $26,204. The President's income tax rate was 25.4% of his reported income. Without his tax cut legislation, he would have paid 29%. Vice President Dick Cheney's 2005 income tax bill was reduced by $1,093,937 due to the Bush tax cuts. The Vice President's income tax rate was only 5.7% of his $9.1 million reported income. Without the Bush tax cuts, he would have paid 17.7%. President Bush's $26,000 tax cut stemmed from both the lower regular tax rates and his reduction in the top rate tax rate on dividends from 39.6% to 15%. Vice President Cheney's $1.1 million tax cut in part reflected the lower regular tax rates and the 15% tax rate on capital gains and dividends. Cheney also was able to take an additional $2.5 million in itemized deductions due to a tax law change signed by Bush in 2005, which was ostensibly designed to encourage charitable donations to the victims of Hurricane Katrina. Normally, charitable deductions cannot offset more than half of a taxpayer's adjusted gross income. Unused deductions can be carried forward for possible use in later years. A special rule for 2005, however, allows unlimited charitable deductions if made after August 27th, the date of the Katrina disaster. The law does not require that these donations be linked in any way to hurricane relief. None of Cheney's charitable donations went to hurricane victims. Instead, they went to the Washington, D.C. hospital that takes care of his heart condition, the University of Wyoming, his alma mater, and Capital Partners for Education, which helps low-income Washington, D.C. students pay private school tuition. Okay, well, that is a press release from Citizens for Tax Justice. There's more details on this, including all the dollar amounts. We got this from commondreams.org. That's the best place to find it. Or you can call the Citizens for Tax Justice at 202-299-1066. That's 202-299-1066. This has been in the news for April 19th, 2006. I'm Scott Berguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. I'll talk to you next time.
And now, the man whose superpowers include talking to squirrels, Mike Cannon.
That was In the News, produced out of Oregon. Coming up next, a nationally played short segment I produce each week called This Week's Iraq Body Count. This segment and many of the programs you're listening to now can be found at a great alternative free download site called radioforall.net. That is radio, then the number 4, then addall.net. Radioforall.net. Here is this week's Iraq Body Count. As always, thanks for tuning in to this alternative indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard every Monday starting at 2 p.m.
Thanks for listening.
Choice is an illusion created between those with power and those without.
What do all men with power want? More power.
Now they knew who was master and leader. Sheep, thought I.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Remorse for what? You people have done everything in the world to me. Doesn't that give me equal right? I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to, because that's what you've done to me. If you spit in my face and smack me in the mouth and throw me in a solitary confinement for nothing, what do you think's gonna happen when I get out of here? Well, I haven't done enough. I might be ashamed of that for not doing enough. For not doing enough. For not being more perceptive. For not being aware enough. For not being standing. For being stupid. Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people, then I would have felt better. Then I felt like I really offered society something. I can. But I find more real in the world that I'm in than I do the tinsel. And the real world is the one I have to deal with every day. Believe me, if I started murdering people, there could not be left.
Chemical weapons threat. Terrorists dangerous die.
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
As of Monday, April 24, 2006, 2,385 United States military personnel had died in Iraq since the start of the invasion. 17,269 United States military personnel had been wounded, over 5,000 of which had suffered grievous injuries such as amputations. 206 other coalition forces had also been killed.
Join us or die.
According to the British medical journal Lancet, over 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died since the start of the invasion.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
What do you see when you're in the dark and the demons come?
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
And now a short musical interlude. 2006. A Spaced Oddity.
She's doing a fine job of coordinating interagency. She's doing what it should have been. The goal of the National Security Advisor is to not only provide good advice to the President, which she does on a regular basis. I value her judgment and her intelligence. Her job is also to deal interagency and to help unstick things that may get stuck. Best way to put it. An unsticker. And is she listening? Okay, well, she's doing a fine job. Her job is also to deal interagency and to help unstick things that may get stuck. Best way to put it. She's an unsticker. And, is she listening? She's doing a fine job. And to help unstick things that may get stuck. Best way to put it. She's an unsticker. And, is she listening? She's doing a fine job. And to help unstick things that may get stuck. Best way to put it. She's an unsticker. She's an unsticker.